You're listening to Around Noon on 90.3. I'm Dee Perry, and this is the show for Thursday, August 30th. Later this hour, we take it from the top with host Christopher O'Reilly as he opens auditions for his public radio program, which comes to the Cleveland Institute of Music later this year. Plus, we'll preview the upcoming Annisfield Wolf Book Awards with Lifetime Achievement winner Taylor Branch, the writer behind the historical trilogy America in the King Year. When he was a little boy growing up in Atlanta, the civil rights movement was something Taylor Branch didn't hear his parents or neighbors talking about. They were middle-class white folks who, at that time, saw the movement as something distant and scary that black people were doing. Still, young Taylor began to learn lessons about race relations, lessons that would one day take over his life. Taylor Branch has dedicated more than two decades to writing about the tumultuous period in American history between 1954 and 1968, when the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. became the charismatic leader of the civil rights movement. Branch's trilogy, America in the King Years, has won him numerous awards, and one of the most recent is the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards Lifetime Achievement Prize. One week from tonight, on September 6th, historian and author Taylor Branch will be in town for the award ceremony at the Cleveland Playhouse. He joined me recently by phone, and he shared some of his early lessons on the racial divide.
The first ones, strong ones I remember was going to baseball games with my dad, who was a big baseball fan, and his cleaner, a black man named Peter Mitchell. And they had quite a relationship, kind of a practical joke relationship. And when we went to baseball games, our team, by the way, was called the Atlanta Crackers, believe it or not, in the Southern Association, Double-A baseball. But because the stadium was segregated in the mid-50s, as we approached the stadium, the banter between my dad and his cleaner died down, and they had to figure out how to get together after the game, because Peter went off and sat in the colored section. Mm-hmm. And I remember him saying a couple of times that he didn't like it.
Your dad saying that?
Yeah, I don't like this. Mm-hmm. And what I really remember from that is that even as a kid, I was maybe 8 years old, 8 or 9, maybe 10 at the oldest. I knew he was saying something very significant, that he didn't like it. Not that he wanted to go into politics or do anything about it. I understood him to mean simply that he didn't like having to shut down his banter with Peter and be gloomy during the game. But what I also knew was that I wasn't supposed to ask any further questions, that this was a pronouncement on a dangerous subject, and that I wasn't supposed to say why or what does that mean or can we do anything about it.
Did there come a point before you got out of your parents' orbit that you did begin to ask those questions?
Well, I asked about them and thought about it. I mean, that's the thing, that the civil rights movement was relentless. If this was 1957 or 58, it was still going all through my formative years, mm-hmm. and it kept going. The sit-ins occurred when I was 14. In 1960, the Freedom Rides when I was 15, or 13 and 14, 50, 60 and 61. So it kept going. Any thoughtful person, in addition to the fear, started raising questions. I went on a baseball scholarship to an elite private high school where a lot of the leaders of Atlanta and even Georgia went, and you couldn't help notice how the adult leadership was tied in knots about how to reconcile segregation with democracy, and it caused a lot of snickering among the kids. So we were all thinking about that. That's kind of normal high school stuff, that the leaders are, hypocrites. So you would think about that, and yet you did it from a position of a comfortable, then segregated school, and nobody thought much about doing anything. I did notice one other thing that really got me thinking, oddly enough, was music, because this was the era of crossover black music, of of Jackie Wilson and the Tams and the Temptations and the Drifters and Hank Ballard and Sam Cooke, and these people would show up in Atlanta a lot, and I noticed that some of my friends who were the most hostile on the race issue would be the very ones to sneak down to a black nightclub to hear Ray Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And that started fascinating me as to how it is that we could be so separated and yet at a deeply emotional level. I think there really were people who believed that that black folks understood the emotional life and love, and that we were just supposed to wear neckties and be stiff and run things. So that was a mystery from my early years.
Yeah. Now, you won the Pulitzer Prize for History for the first installment of your Martin Luther King trilogy, America in the King Years. During the years when he was alive, did you ever get to see him speak or even meet him in person?
I never saw or I never heard him speak. I never saw him in person,
mm-hmm.
even though we were born and lived in the same city. By the time I really got interested and my life's interest got changed against my will, I was going off to college in 1964 and left Atlanta, wasn't there very much. And before I finished college, he was killed. So I was under the spell of the civil rights movement and profoundly interested in it, and switched from pre-med to history solely trying to figure out and make some sense of the emotional wallop of the civil rights years. But I didn't catch up with it enough to actually go see him.
Is that what you meant by against your will, that when the assassination happened, that you were trying to make sense of it?
No, what I meant was a little earlier than that. When I was toward the end of high school, I when I saw the demonstrations over in Birmingham of these small children being hit by fire hoses and dogs, I had a very strong reaction to that, saying, what does this mean? This has been going on my whole childhood, and everybody's been trying to keep it at arm's length, and I can't do it anymore. It goes too deep. They're singing the same songs I sing in Sunday school. What does this mean? And so when I got to college, I lost interest in my pre-med courses. And what I meant by that is that the direction of my life interest changed against my will. I wasn't looking to have it happen. It just wore me down. And so through the course of college, by the time Dr. King was killed, I knew I was really interested in politics and, in fact, was planning to go on into graduate school in political philosophy and go into politics or writing about it.
I'm here with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch, and this year the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards are honoring him with their Lifetime Achievement Award for his historical trilogy, America in the King Years. When you began that project, did you see down the road that it needed to be a trilogy, or did that realization come later?
Oh, it came much later. I knew that it was something that I had always wanted to do. As I just explained, it's the reason that I got into this in the first place. I knew it had a very powerful effect on me and my whole generation. And I wanted to write a narrative history, and then I planned for it to take 3 years, which was three times longer than any of my earlier books.
Mm.
So I knew it was a big project, but I had no idea it was going to take 24 years and be three books. My wife would have thrown me out of the house.
Another project of yours is getting a lot of attention lately, and you're writing about another sort of lightning rod kind of figure, a former colleague of yours, Bill Clinton. Tell us about Wrestling History, the Bill Clinton tapes.
Well, I can't tell you a lot because I'm just working on it.
Yeah, I'm curious about the process. Where and when did your conversations happen?
Well, they happened pretty much all through his presidency, almost always late at night in the White House residence, taping an oral history of his presidency. It was at his initiative. We had known each other 20 years before, but had been separated, and he read my Parting the Waters book and contacted me when he was president-elect and said, in a nutshell, what he said was, I read the footnotes in Parting the Waters, the material that you draw out of all these presidential libraries. Do you think historians will be able to find material to do the same thing 50 years from now in my library? Do you know enough about the way records are being gathered? And I thought it was a very impressive question to be asking before he'd even taken office. Yeah. He was thinking about, you know, what kind of material would be in the library and that sort of thing. And I told him, I did a survey for him and told him I thought things were going to be pretty bad, pretty much dry, that they weren't planning to take notes in his meetings, and he wasn't going to tape his telephone calls, and that there would be a lot of things that I had relied on heavily that wouldn't exist. And as a palliative or to do something about it, one of the things he wanted to do was to tape a running oral history. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And this book, the book I'm doing now, is kind of a memoir of that process, what it's like to sit with the president trying to record his view of what's really going on behind the scenes, right in the middle of the, you know, the storm as president.
Yeah, that will be fascinating to read, because I'm very curious about how candid he was and how open about his thoughts and what your reactions as a writer are.
Yes, well, a lot of times I was head over heels just trying to keep an even keel and move on to the next question. And but it was quite an experience for me. I mean, even in my own internal debate over what my proper role was, because the main role was to try to get things down on the record for posterity so that people could study what the president was saying and leaving on the record. So that was the overriding thing. But I'm also a citizen, and I'm also his friend. And if he asked me, you know, do you think I'm doing the right thing? What should I say, and should I divert from trying to get, what are the priorities of history here? And over time, that became difficult on a few occasions. But most of it was simply trying to ask questions to elicit from him the most information that would help people understand the presidency when it came to write history.
Great. And finally, I would love to have you respond to what it means to you to receive the Annis Field Wolfe Lifetime Achievement Award.
Well, it means a lot to me because Cleveland is a city that is invested in history. I've been there and lectured several times before. It is and has been a center not just for people who are serious about the meaning of American history and American citizenship, our distinctive notion as the kind of only country founded on an idea, but a peculiar and distinctive awareness that race relations have been tied up in that question of what American citizenship means from the beginning. So to have a prize there and dedicated to the place of race relations in particular in our history means a lot to me, because that's really the door that I came through in getting fascinated and devoting my life really to the study of American history, was through race relations. You know, we talk about civil rights, which technically means rights pertaining to citizenship, but it's become a synonym for African-American rights because their rights have been the ones most consistently abridged. And you can learn a lot because, you know, what we mean by equal citizenship has been tested most often in our history by the way we treat people across the race line.
Well, I'm so pleased to have had a chance to talk with you and look forward to the ceremony here in town. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
This year's Lifetime Achievement winner of the Annis Field Wolfe Book Award, Taylor Branch. He's author of the trilogy America in the King Years. And 1 week from tonight, at the Cleveland Playhouse, is the 72nd annual Annis Field Wolfe Book Award ceremony. You can find the Cleveland Playhouse at 8500 Euclid Avenue. You should also know that reservations for the award ceremony are already at capacity, but if you call the Cleveland Foundation at 216-615-7599, you will be put on a waiting list in case seats open up. Again, that number for the Cleveland Foundation is 216-615-7599. You can also find out more when you log on to our homepage online at WCPN.org, where you can hear today's show on demand. And be sure to tune in next Thursday, September 6th, as I welcome the three other winners of this year's Annisfield Wolf Book Award.